Hey, it's Dolo White, and this is the Dolo White Podcast. Of course, February is Black History Month, and I thought it would be a great time to have Tori Yates Orr on the podcast. Tori is an Emmy-nominated history communicator, and we really had a dope conversation about the importance of Black history, and not just American Black history either. I believe it was Maya Angelou who once said, quote, "History, despite its wrenching pain, cannot be unlived, but if faced with courage, need not be lived again." Now, I know you probably think I'm super intelligent because I just pulled out a Maya Angelou quote, but don't give me too much credit, because I got a confession. I googled it. Welcome to the Dolo White Podcast.
Polo Gini. Live. Yeah. What's up?
This is not live. It's completely recorded.
Broadcasting from one of the top recording studios in all of Nashville, Tennessee.
Yeah, that's not true at all. I'm probably at home doing this.
He's been called one of the greatest thinkers of his time.
Literally no one has ever called me that. I do kind of agree with it, though.
A 2017 recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize.
That's just a flat-out lie.
Talking politics, community, race, religion, entertainment, sports, and whatever the fuck else. Yeah. It's the Dolo White Podcast.
Episode 10 of the Dolo White Podcast. My guest today, Emmy-nominated history communicator Tori Yates Orr. Thank you for being here. Thank you for doing this.
Thank you for having me. I'm honored.
I felt like it's Black History Month. I should do something surrounding Black history here, and you're my history connect. So I thought maybe we could share some stories if you had some, maybe some things that most people don't know, because unfortunately we're not taught much about Black history growing up in schools. So what's one of your favorites? Let's start there.
Well, I think for most people, when we study Black history, for myself included, it was basically like slavery, maybe a little bit of Reconstruction, civil rights movement.
Right.
That's it.
Like a whole 100 years went by and like nobody said anything about it.
Exactly. Yeah. It was like, were Black people there? We don't know. And so that used to irritate me. And like, that's a big reason, even like as a kid, I got into history, was because I was like, there's other stories here that we're not hearing. I mean, I think it's interesting that we talk about Black people as basically just kind of showing up enslaved.
Right.
Not that we had histories for thousands and eons before that. So I think that's a really big part that's really important to me. I think talking about the Kingdom of Mali and how Timbuktu at one point was the center of knowledge and people came there to learn, and it was a center of gold trading. And I think there's just so many stories we don't talk about. And it's also a very American narrative, very American focused. We don't even talk about the slave trade in Brazil and how South America got the majority of the enslaved people. We tend to focus on the American story, as we should. We're in America. I get it.
It's funny that you brought up before the slave trade, because I always tell people one of the main white privileges is genealogy. We can go back and we can trace so far back. But the thing that happened with slavery is that people were brought over. That's maybe as far as most Black people can go back with their genealogy, is I was related to this slave that was brought over here from this time at that point. And that's about as far as it goes. Which is,
yeah. That's a great point, in that if you know your history, there's a power in that.
Yeah.
There's a power in knowing where you come from. And people who were brought over as enslaved persons, that was cut off from us. So I think it is interesting going back and doing genealogy. I've done mine. I found some very interesting things in there. But in terms of like the African side, yeah, it basically stops of like, all right, that person came over from Africa. And
right.
It's never even like a region of Africa.
It's just Africa, right? Like Africa's like not Africa. A huge continent, right?
Yeah, Africa. I mean, the majority of people who came over as enslaved people were from West Africa. We know that now. But you're absolutely right. There is a privilege in knowing where you come from and being able to trace that back. There's a power in that that was stolen from African Americans. And that I think we're now starting to reclaim. I think you see a lot of people are kind of returning to Africa or exploring those roots. You see a lot of people who are interested in African religions. And I think that is a conscious and subconscious understanding of like, there's more to our story that we haven't been taught.
Right.
I think that's really key.
My wife studies some African religions as well and puts that in some of her meditation practices and things of that nature. And people have like one definition of what religion is, and it all centers around Christianity, and that's it. And it's weird to see people kind of look down on these past religions that were just lost, literally lost. To see some of these religions kind of making a comeback, I think it's personally a beautiful thing to incorporate some of these practices that none of us knew anything about growing up.
And I think it's really important to understand too that a lot of our African ancestors carried that religion into our Christian religion. There's a difference between a white church and a black church. Let's keep it 100. Yeah. That song, that dance, that call and response, that comes back from that African religion. The tradition of pouring one out for the homies is libations from African religion.
I did not know that. See?
Yeah, that's ancestral veneration. That's been around for years. Wow. That's saying, I want to honor the people who have gone on. So there you go. So these things aren't necessarily lost. I think what happened too is, like you're saying, it's a very Christian focus. I mean, I grew up in the church. I get it. But I think what happened is we need to understand that Christianity was also used against enslaved people to control them. So by telling them the things that you worshiped were demons and bad, it has created an entire line of people who also view those things as demonic or bad. And it's not. A large amount of African religions are very nature-based. The gods or deities are connected to rivers or mountains or metals. So there's nothing to fear. And I think there is a way where we can acknowledge our African traditions and even incorporate them into our Christian traditions that we have now.
Beyonce, I think it was, I think she caught a lot of flack for using symbolism of, was it Hathor? I hope I'm saying that right.
Hathor,
yes. Yeah, I think she used some kind of symbolism with Hathor and I saw a lot of people like, oh, it's demonic. I'm like, I don't think so.
It's really not. And you know, it's interesting. Throughout history, people who have come in and been like, this is the religion we're going to push on you, have incorporated the previous religion. So if you look at Egyptian mythology, there's a lot of deities who have a gold disc above their head, which looks very similar to our halos. We have Isis and Horus. Isis the mother with Horus in her hands, very similar to Mary and Jesus. It's not believed that Jesus actually was born in December 25th. It's connected to the winter solstice. So it's just kind of incorporating things from the previous. And what's really funny about the Beyonce thing is Hathor's like the most calm, not calm, but like nothing controversial. She's right. Just beauty, perfumes, like dancing. Her other half, not great, but Hathor, wonderful. So no need to be afraid of that.
What other traditions can you talk about that we've carried on today that we may not know that came from Africa?
People know jumping the broom. If they don't know, slaves could not get married technically. So to symbolize their union, they would jump over a broom and that meant that they were betrothed. And so you see that in a lot of like African-American weddings where people jump the broom. Call and response is so connected to the African culture. I'm about to do a video right now on HBCU bands and how that is directly connected to the fact that during the 1700s, Black people and people of color were forced into militias, to like colonial militias, right? They didn't give them weapons. They weren't allowed to have weapons because of course they weren't. So instead that they were given instruments. And so it started a pattern of these people of color being given these instruments and taking it and changing it into their own and adding their own rhythms into the cadence when they're marching. And that led up all the way to our Black marching bands that we know and love so well. So there are just so many traditions that have evolved and that we've kept. So I think a lot of times there is a narrative that Africans lost everything when they came across the ocean, but it's not true. We retained a lot. A lot of it is still there. That's a testament to the resilience of Black people.
Those musical influence probably still play a part in music today. I didn't see the PBS documentary on country music, but from what I heard, there was a large influence of African Americans in country music, which I don't think many people know that.
Yeah, no, it was huge. It was a big thing for me too. I think it's interesting that when we think of like rural people, we don't think Black people.
Right.
But like Black people were farmers and sharecroppers before a lot of the people in America. So they were playing those same kind of Appalachian music before it became country music and before country became racialized and segregated. Those kind of rhythms of country music, those harmonies, a lot of that does come from the Black culture.
If you listen to older blues music and older country music, you can hear those similarities. I mean, they're right there in front of you. And, you know, you just don't think about it. You think, like you said, country music, white, but that's not the case at all.
A lot of that is marketing it to, you know, a certain demographic. But I think when you do that, you limit people seeing how worldly this is.
You do a lot of videos on your Instagram that I love. And you recently did one with Cicely Tyson, which was great. I saw Mary Wilson of the Supremes, yes, passed away at 76. Are we going to expect a Mary Wilson video out of you coming soon?
I would love to do that. My family's from Detroit. My mom grew up on 8 Mile. So I would love to do something on Mary Wilson because I don't think her story is told enough. obviously she kind of gets outshined by Miss Diana Ross.
Right.
I think my mom will probably force me to do a video on Gary Wilson.
Speaking of your mom is Black History in the city we live in Nashville, Tennessee. How long has she been broadcasting here now?
Oh, she's been in Nashville 30, wow. almost 31 years. Yeah.
How long has she been doing this total?
My mom's been at 40 something years.
Wow. That means she was in it in the 80s, which I'm sure being an African-American newscaster anchor person in the 80s was a lot different than it is now. And I don't mean different in a good way. So, I mean, she's probably broke down a lot of barriers herself.
She absolutely has. And I think, you know, it's interesting with my mom's job now. I don't know a lot of people know this, but she has a couple people removed. Oprah Winfrey's old job.
Yeah.
Oprah Winfrey's mentor, Chris Clark, was my mom's co-anchor for years. But yeah, that's an industry that took a lot of time. Yeah. I know my mom has come up against it. I remember she told me about one story, I believe in Pittsburgh, where she went out to do a story and the news directors thought, we need to send a white male to do the story. So while she's on the actual scene, they send another man to take her story. My mom, if anyone knows my mom, is like the most kind, soft-spoken person in the world. She was not that day. She went back and gave that news director a piece of her mind and he never did it again.
Wow.
So I think it's a lot of, especially Black women, of having to say, this is my boundary. You're not going to walk all over me. And we tend to get the stereotype of the angry Black woman.
Mm-hmm.
When in actuality, it's like, we would be taken advantage of. We have been taken advantage of so many times, and we haven't been given our due. So we have to stand up for ourselves. So my mom definitely had to do that in that situation.
I'm sure just your mom growing up and telling people, like, I want to be, you know, a news anchor back then, was she was up against it.
100%. You know, it's interesting. I asked my mom, I'm like, did you have like grand plans? And she was like, well, I started doing TV writing, and then someone said, the money's made when you're in front of the camera. And so she was like, you know what? I can do it. And she's not seeing a lot of other Black women to base that trajectory off of. But she made it happen. My mom is just the queen of making it happen.
Yeah. She's a legend in this city for sure, without question. Sure. All right, so let's get into some specifics here. Tell us a good Black history story that we may not know that may blow our minds here. What do you got?
So one of my favorites, and I think it honors both of these women, is that Rosa Parks was not the original woman who sat and protested for the bus boycotts. It was a young girl by the name of Claudette Colvin. She was 15, and she sat and refused to get up and was arrested. However, she was not seen as kind of a good emblem for the movement because she was a young girl. She was darker skinned. She was a teenage mother. That was seen as like, yes, you did it, but we're going to have Rosa Parks actually take this motion. And I think a lot of times too with Rosa Parks, what I think is really interesting is that people paint her as, you know, she just sat on this bus and she was just really tired. No. Rosa Parks was planning all this. Rosa Parks was strategic about how she was doing this. Rosa Parks was an activist. This was not new to her. She knew exactly what she was doing. And so I think a lot of times it's kind of painted like this sweet Rosa Parks. Like she just wanted to sit down and then she changed the world. Like, no, this was a plan to change the world. And I think she needs to be given that respect as well.
History doesn't teach Rosa Parks, as you just put her, as like a civil rights activist. They teach her as a woman on a bus that didn't want to get up. And it seems like her story ends then.
And I think that's partially due to design, because if you paint her as like an activist who connected with a group of people and they designed this and they strategically did nonviolent protest, that gives people more of an idea of like, oh, that's actually a really smart way to go about it. Instead of just like, oh yeah, that sweet woman just wanted to sit down. Because that's kind of how I was taught.
Yeah.
And then I did my research and I was like, she was a bad bitch.
She wasn't playing with him. She knew what she was doing. Do you have some Nashville specific Black history story that you'd like to tell?
I think it's really important for people to understand the lunch counter boycotts that came here. I think people maybe don't know to the extent of how they were boycotting Woolworths. I mean, this is John Lewis. This was led by young college students. And then I also think it's important, especially in that way, some of these people are still alive. Like Diane Nash needs to be honored in this city. She is a vital part of the civil rights movement, not just in this city, but worldwide.
Yeah, I grew up in Georgia, and we're taught, you know, Atlanta, Birmingham, mm-hmm. a little Memphis. Nashville kind of gets skipped over in the civil rights movement outside of the city. Maybe they teach it here. I don't know. But I think that's sad because, like you said, the lunch counter boycotts here were huge. And massive. I remember, I think the quote from Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and this is not a direct quote. It was something to the effect of, he came to Nashville to be inspired rather than to give inspiration to the movement here in Nashville. So I think that says a lot itself.
It's important to understand, like, Nashville is the Athens of the South because of how many, like, universities and colleges we have here, but also of the power of those young people, the power of the people at Fisk, the power of the people at CSU who understood, like, this is a movement we can get behind and we can organize on our own. When I was 18, I was not doing that. Right. Like, I did not, I don't know about you.
Yeah, no.
I didn't have the wherewithal to plan that.
No.
But knowledge of your history is power. Knowledge of other people knowing your history is power. If you are in school, like for me, like when I was in high school, it kind of goes back to what I was saying about slavery, Reconstruction, mm-hmm. civil rights. In that way, I think it's easy to not see the humanity in Black people because you're just seeing them as enslaved and then the civil rights movement. Instead of seeing these details about these human beings, the founding fathers were allowed to, you know, be given personalities. We can be like, oh, we know what that person was like. Black history was not necessarily given that respect and that complexity. And so I think now that there's more interest in Black history, we're getting to see that. We're getting to see the humans behind these mythical people. We're growing and we're learning and we're seeing the humanity behind these stories, behind these histories.
Are you familiar with the 1619 Project?
Yes.
Can you give us a recap of what exactly that is? I'm sure you could say way better than I could. So
the 1619 Project was done in collaboration with the New York Times, which basically talks about the history from when the first slaves arrived in the Americas. There's been a lot of backlash against it because people do not want to talk about this. People do not want to talk about the fact that our country was built off the backs of free labor, off the backs of enslaved people.
Right.
So there's been a lot of pushback against it. There was a dumbass 1776 commission.
I saw that. That was so stupid.
That, like, every historian I know was like, what the hell is this? But it's examining the slave trade, looking at the lives of enslaved people with actual nuance, with actual humanity, and seeing also how they were integral to making America what it is. I research a lot about, like, mythology, but I don't think we talk about, like, the myth of America and the ideals of America and how if we do not examine the things that are in the 1619 Project, if we do not look at that and actually see how we stole, kidnapped people from their homes to build the America we put on this pedestal, we can't make America better if we don't look at that wound.
Right.
So I think that's a big part of why the 1619 Project got a lot of backlashes, because people are not ready to look at it.
Other countries who have taught their own history in a much more honest, much more brutal way have seen dividends off of that. From what I understand, that Germany, from the time that they send their kids off to school, they learn about the Holocaust, the Nazi regime, every day until they get out of school. I just think it's a much more honest, better way to teach history.
It's holding on to the story that isn't necessary anymore.
Right.
It's more exciting to be like, all right, if we examine this dark, horrible history that we have at the, you know, base of our country, it's more exciting to think about, well, what can we make it from here on out?
Right.
Like, that's why I think history is so important, because we can look back at it, like you were saying, like countries like Germany, and be like, how can we progress better? And that's the most important thing about looking back at that history. I'm going to keep it completely 100. My great grandfather was born a slave. He was the son of a person who owned slaves and their enslaved mother. So he was a product of a rape. But that's the history that we have, that I've had to deal with. Most Black people in America carry a lot of times the last name of the person who owned them. That's heavy.
I hear it can be passed down in DNA too. I've heard there's been some studies that some of that trauma has been passed down in DNA.
There's been a couple studies about that. And that's never really been addressed, of how that trauma could live.
Yeah.
I mean, to think about it. But like I said, this story we've been holding on to is just not useful anymore.
Tori Azor, thank you for doing this. Where can we find you on Instagram and Twitter? And if you don't follow Tori, she does amazing videos based on history. They all are very indulging. They're very quick. It's like you're giving these out to people with short attention spans, but you get so much information in such a little time. It's really dope the way you do them.
Thank you so much. I try. We'll see if it works. Hopefully it does. I don't know.
Follow her on Instagram at Tori Yates Orr, correct?
Yep. Just my name.
All right.
That's the same on Twitter as well.
You also host like 12 podcasts. So go ahead and pump those too.
I'm only on two. I'm on Vote Hers with the lovely Savannah Grimm. And I'm on Vote Hers. And then I have one that talks about mythology and history in pop culture called Skeleton Keys.
Awesome. You're going to come back and talk about mythology. I know nothing about mythology, so it might just be me saying, hey, it's Tori. Here's some mythology. And then you taking it from there because
I've got you.
I'll be here lost. Yeah. All right. Tori Azor, thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you.
All right. This episode of the podcast brought to you by my good friend, William Wilson of the Hammonds Group. What more can I say about William Wilson I haven't already said? He's a great realtor. He's a great friend of mine. He has an adorable daughter who likes to eat and needs toys. So what are you waiting for? If you're looking to buy or sell in the state of Tennessee, give my guy, my good friend, William Wilson, a call today. 615-216-4809. Again, 615-216-4809. Give my guy, William Wilson of the Hammonds Group, your business when it comes to buying and selling here in the state of Tennessee. Again, want to thank my guest, Emmy-nominated history communicator Tori Yates Orr, for being on the podcast today. If you haven't caught up on all of the episodes, do so right now. A lot of winter storms going on, so what else are you really doing? Binge listen to the Dolewhite Podcast. Make sure you subscribe. Make sure you download each and every episode. Definitely appreciate the love. Also, follow me Instagram and Twitter at Dolewhite101, Dolewhite101. My clubhouse is exactly the same as well. That's it. Till next week, I'm out.